It was the Sackville Bagginses that were his downfall, as you might expect. One day, a year before the party, I happened to be walking along the road when I saw Bilbo ahead. Suddenly, in the distance, the SPs appeared, coming towards us. Bilbo slowed down, and then, hey presto, he vanished. I was so startled that I hardly had the wits to hide myself in a more ordinary fashion, but I got through the hedge and walked along the field inside. I was peeping through into the road after the SBs had passed, and was looking straight at Bilbo when he suddenly reappeared. I caught a glint of gold as he put something back in his trouser pocket. After that I kept my eyes open. In fact, I confess I spied. But you must admit that it was very intriguing, and I was only in my teens. I must be the only one in the Shire, besides you, Frodo, that's ever seen the old fellow's secret book. "You've read his book," cried Frodo. "Good heavens above! Is nothing safe?" "Not too safe, I should say," said Merry. "But I've only had one rapid glance, and that was difficult to get. He never left the book about. I wonder what became of it. I should like another look. Have you got it, Frodo?" "No, it wasn't at Bag End. He must have taken it away." "Well, as I was saying," Merry proceeded, "I kept my knowledge to myself till this spring when things got serious. Then we formed our conspiracy, and as we were serious too and meant business, we've not been too scrupulous. You're not a very easy nut to crack, and Gandalf is worse. But if you want to be introduced to our chief investigator, I can produce him." "Where is he?" said Frodo, looking round, as if he expected a masked and sinister figure to come out of a cupboard. "Step forward, Sam," said Merry, and Sam stood up with a face scarlet up to the ears. "Here's our collector of information, and he collected a lot, I can tell you, before he was finally caught. After which, I may say, he seemed to regard himself as on parole and dried up." "Sam!" cried Frodo, feeling that amazement could go no further, and quite unable to decide whether he felt angry, amused, relieved, or merely foolish. "Yes, sir," said Sam. "Begging your pardon, sir, but I meant no wrong to you, Mr. Frodo, nor to Mr. Gandalf, for that matter. He has some sense, mind you, and when you said, 'Go alone,' he said, 'No, take someone as you can trust.'" "But it doesn't seem that I can trust anyone," said Frodo. Sam looked at him unhappily. "It all depends on what you want," put in Merry. "You can trust us to stick to you through thick and thin, to the bitter end, and you can trust us to keep any secret of yours closer than you keep it yourself. But you can't trust us to let you face trouble alone, and go off without a word. Where are your friends, Frodo? Anyway, there it is. We know most of what Gandalf has told you. We know a good deal about the ring. We're horribly afraid, but we're coming with you, or following you like hounds." "And after all, sir," added Sam, "you did ought to take the elves' advice. Gildor said you should take them as was willing, and you can't deny it." "I don't deny it," said Frodo, looking at Sam, who was now grinning. "I don't deny it, but I'll never believe you're sleeping again, whether you snore or not. I'll kick you hard to make sure." "You are a set of deceitful scoundrels," he said, turning to the others. "But bless you," he laughed, getting up and waving his arms, "I give in. I'll take Gildor's advice. If the danger weren't so dark, I should dance for joy. Even so, I can't help feeling happy. Happier than I've felt for a long time. I dreaded this evening." "Good! That's settled! 3 cheers for Captain Frodo and company," they shouted, and they danced round him. Merry and Pippin began a song, which they had apparently got ready for the occasion. It was made on the model of the dwarf song that started Bilbo on his adventure long ago, and went to the same tune. "Farewell, we call to hearth and hall, though wind may blow and rain may fall. We must away at break of day, far over wood and mountain tall.
to Rivendell, where elves yet dwell, in glades beneath the misty fell. Through moor and waste we ride in haste, and whither then we cannot tell. With foes ahead, behind us dread, beneath the sky shall be our bed, until at last our toil be past, our journey done, our errand sped. We must away, we ride before the break of day.
Very good, said Frodo, but in that case there are a lot of things to do before we go to bed. Under a roof, for tonight at any rate. Oh, that was poetry, said Pippin. Do you really mean to start before the break of day? I don't know, answered Frodo. I fear those black riders, and I'm sure it's unsafe to stay in one place long, especially in a place to which it's known I was going. Also, Gildor advised me not to wait. But I should very much like to see Gandalf. I could see that even Gildor was disturbed when he heard that Gandalf had never appeared. It really depends on two things. How soon could the riders get to Bucklebury, and how soon could we get off? It'll take a good deal of preparation. The answer to the second question, said Merry, is that we could get off in an hour. I've prepared practically everything. There are 6 ponies in a stable across the fields. Stores and tackle are all packed, except for a few extra clothes and the perishable food. It seems to have been a very efficient conspiracy, said Frodo. But what about the Black Riders? Would it be safe to wait one day for Gandalf? That all depends on what you think the Riders would do. If they found you here, answered Merry, they could have reached here by now, of course, if they weren't stopped at the North Gate, where the hedge runs down to the river bank, just this side of the bridge. The gate guards wouldn't let them through by night, though they might break through. Even in the daylight they'd try to keep them out, I think, at any rate until they got a message through to the master of the hall, for they wouldn't like the look of the riders, and would certainly be frightened by them. But, of course, Buckland can't resist a determined attack for long, and it's possible that in the morning even a black rider that rode up and asked for Mr. Baggins would be let through. It's pretty generally known that you're coming back to live at Crick Hollow. Frodo sat for a while in thought. I've made up my mind, he said finally. I'm starting tomorrow, as soon as it's light, but I'm not going by road. It would be safer to wait here than that. If I go through the North Gate, my departure from Buckland will be known at once, instead of being secret for several days at least, as it might be. And what's more, the bridge and the East Road near the borders will certainly be watched, whether any rider gets into Buckland or not. We don't know how many there are, but there are at least 2, and possibly more. The only thing to do is to go off in a quite unexpected direction.
But that can only mean going into the Old Forest, said Fredegar, horrified. You can't be thinking of doing that. It's quite as dangerous as Black Riders.
Not quite, said Merry. It sounds very desperate, but I believe Frodo's right. It's the only way of getting off without being followed at once. With luck, we might get a considerable start.
But you won't have any luck in the Old Forest, objected Fredegar. No one ever has luck in there. You'll get lost. People don't go in there.
Oh, yes, they do, said Merry. The Brandybucks go in, occasionally, when the fit takes them. We have a private entrance. Frodo went in once, long ago. I've been in several times, usually in daylight, of course, when the trees are sleepy and fairly quiet.
Well, do as you think best, said Fredegar. I'm more afraid of the Old Forest than of anything I know about. The stories about it are a nightmare, but my vote hardly counts, as I'm not going on the journey. Still, I am very glad someone is stopping behind who can tell Gandalf what you've done when he turns up, as I'm sure he will before long.
Fond as he was of Frodo, Fatty Bulger had no desire to leave the Shire, nor to see what lay outside it. His family came from the East Farthing, from Budgeford in Bridgefield, in fact, but had never been over the Brandywine Bridge. His task, according to the original plans of the conspirators, was to stay behind and deal with inquisitive folk, and to keep up as long as possible the pretense that Mr. Baggins was still living at Crick Hollow. He'd even brought along some old clothes of Frodo's to help him in playing the part. They little thought how dangerous that part might prove. "Excellent," said Frodo when he understood the plan. "We couldn't have left any message behind for Gandalf otherwise. I don't know whether these riders can read or not, of course, but I shouldn't have dared to risk a written message in case they got in and searched the house. But if Fatty's willing to hold the fort, and I can be sure of Gandalf knowing the way we've gone, that decides me. I'm going into the Old Forest first thing tomorrow." "Well, that's that," said Pippin. "On the whole, I'd rather have our job than Fatty's, waiting here till Black Riders come."
"You wait till you're well inside the forest," said Fredegar. "You'll wish you were back with me before this time tomorrow."
"It's no good arguing about it any more," said Merry. "We've still got to tidy up and put the finishing touches to the packing before we get to bed. I shall call you all before the break of day."
When at last he'd got to bed, Frodo couldn't sleep for some time. His legs ached. He was glad that he was riding in the morning. Eventually he fell into a vague dream in which he seemed to be looking out of a high window over a dark sea of tangled trees. Down below, among the roots, there was the sound of creatures crawling and snuffling. He felt they would smell him out sooner or later. Then he heard a noise in the distance. At first he thought it was a great wind coming over the leaves of the forest. Then he knew that it was not leaves, but the sound of the sea far off, a sound he had never heard in waking life, though it had often troubled his dreams. Suddenly he found he was out in the open. There were no trees after all. He was on a dark heath, and there was a strange salt smell in the air. Looking up, he saw before him a tall white tower, standing alone on a high ridge. A great desire came over him to climb the tower and see the sea. He started to struggle up the ridge toward the tower, but suddenly a light came in the sky, and there was a noise of thunder.
Chapter 6 The Old Forest. Frodo woke suddenly. It was still dark in the room. Merry was standing there with a candle in one hand and banging on the door with the other.
"All right, what is it?" said Frodo, still shaken and bewildered.
"What is it?" cried Merry. "It's time to get up. It's 4:30 and very foggy. Come on. Sam's already getting breakfast ready. Even Pippin is up. I'm just going to saddle the ponies and fetch the one that's to be the baggage carrier. Wake that sluggard Fatty. At least he must get up and see us off."
Soon after 6 o'clock, the 5 hobbits were ready to start. Fatty Bulger was still yawning. They stole quietly out of the house. Merry went in front, leading a laden pony, and took his way along a path that went through a spinney behind the house, and then cut across several fields. The leaves of trees were glistening, and every twig was dripping. The grass was grey with cold dew. Everything was still, and far away noises seemed near and clear. Fowls chattering in a yard, someone closing a door of a distant house. In their shed they found the ponies, sturdy little beasts of the kind loved by hobbits, not speedy, but good for a long day's work. They mounted, and soon they were riding off into the mist, which seemed to open reluctantly before them and close forbiddingly behind them. After riding for about an hour, slowly and without talking, they saw the hedge looming suddenly ahead. It was tall and netted over with silver cobwebs.
"How are you going to get through this?" asked Fredegar.
"Follow me," said Merry, "and you'll see."
He turned to the left along the hedge, and soon they came to a point where it bent inwards, running along the lip of a hollow. A cutting had been made, at some distance from the hedge, and went sloping gently down into the ground. It had walls of brick at the sides, which rose steadily, until suddenly they arched over and formed a tunnel that dived deep under the hedge and came out in the hollow on the other side.
Here Fatty Bulger halted.
"Goodbye, Frodo," he said. "I wish you weren't going into the forest. I only hope you'll not need rescuing before the day's out. But good luck to you, today and every day."
"If there are no worse things ahead than the Old Forest, I shall be lucky," said Frodo. "Tell Gandalf to hurry along the East Road. We shall soon be back on it, and going as fast as we can." "Goodbye," they cried, and rode down the slope and disappeared from Fredegar's sight into the tunnel. It was dark and damp. At the far end, it was closed by a gate of thick-set iron bars. Merry got down and unlocked the gate, and when they'd all passed through, he pushed it to again. It shut with a clang, and the lock clicked. The sound was ominous. "There," said Merry. "You've left the Shire, and are now outside and on the edge of the Old Forest."
"Are the stories about it true?" asked Pippin.
"I don't know what stories you mean," Merry answered. "If you mean the old bogey stories Fatty's nurses used to tell him, about goblins and wolves and things of that sort, I should say no. At any rate, I don't believe them. But the forest is queer. Everything in it very much more alive, more aware of what's going on, so to speak, than things are in the Shire. And the trees don't like strangers. They watch you. They're usually content merely to watch you, as long as daylight lasts, and don't do much. Occasionally the most unfriendly ones may drop a branch, or stick a root out, or grasp at you with a long trailer. But at night things can be most alarming, or so I'm told. I've only once or twice been in here after dark, and then only near the hedge. I thought all the trees were whispering to each other, passing news and plots along in an unintelligible language, and the branches swayed and groped without any wind. They do say the trees do actually move, and can surround strangers and hem them in. In fact, long ago they attacked the hedge. They came and planted themselves right by it and leaned over it. But the hobbits came and cut down hundreds of trees and made a great bonfire in the forest and burned all the ground in a long strip east of the hedge. After that the trees gave up the attack, but they became very unfriendly. There's still a wide, bare space not far inside where the bonfire was made."
"Is it only the trees that are dangerous?" asked Pippin.
"There are various queer things living deep in the forest and on the far side," said Merry. "Or at least I've heard so, but I haven't seen any of them. But some things make paths. Whenever one comes inside, one finds open tracks, but they seem to shift and change from time to time in a queer fashion. Not far from this tunnel there is, or was for a long time, the beginning of quite a broad path leading to the bonfire glade, and then on more or less in our direction, east and a little north. That is the path I'm going to try and find."
The hobbits now left the tunnel gate and rode across the wide hollow. On the far side was a faint path leading up onto the floor of the forest, 100 yards and more beyond the hedge. But it vanished as soon as it brought them under the trees. Looking back, they could see the dark line of the hedge through the stems of trees that were already thick about them. Looking ahead, they could see only tree trunks of innumerable sizes and shapes, straight or bent, twisted, leaning, squat or slender, smooth or gnarled and branched, and all the stems were green or grey with moss and slimy, shaggy growths. Merry alone seemed fairly cheerful. "You'd better lead on and find that path," Frodo said to him. "Don't let's lose one another, or forget which way the hedge lies." They picked away among the trees, and their ponies plodded along, carefully avoiding the many writhing and interlacing roots. There was no undergrowth. The ground was rising steadily, and as they went forward, it seemed that the trees became taller, darker, and thicker. There was no sound except an occasional drip of moisture falling through the still leaves. For the moment there was no whispering or movement among the branches. But they all got an uncomfortable feeling that they were being watched with disapproval, deepening to dislike and even enmity. The feeling steadily grew until they found themselves looking up quickly, or glancing back over their shoulders as if they expected a sudden blow. There was not as yet any sign of a path, and the trees seemed constantly to bar their way. Pippin suddenly felt that he could not bear it any longer, and without warning let out a shout.
"Oi! Oi!" he cried. "I'm not going to do anything. Just let me pass through, will you?"
The others halted, startled, but the cry fell as if muffled by a heavy curtain. There was no echo or answer, though the wood seemed to become more crowded and more watchful than before.
"I shouldn't shout if I were you," said Merry. "It does more harm than good."
Frodo began to wonder if it were possible to find a way through, and if he'd been right to make the others come into this abominable wood. Merry was looking from side to side, and seemed already uncertain which way to go. Pippin noticed it.
"It hasn't taken you long to lose us," he said.
But at that moment Merry gave a whistle of relief and pointed ahead.
"Well, well," he said, "these trees do shift. There's the bonfire glade in front of us, or I hope so, but the path to it seems to have moved away."
The light grew clearer as they went forward. Suddenly they came out of the trees and found themselves in a wide circular space. There was sky above them, blue and clear to their surprise, for down under the forest roof they'd not been able to see the rising morning and the lifting of the mist. The sun was not, however, high enough yet to shine down into the clearing, though its light was on the treetops. The leaves were all thicker and greener about the edges of the glade, enclosing it with an almost solid wall. No tree grew there, only rough grass and many tall plants. Stalky and faded hemlocks, and wood parsley, fireweed seeding into fluffy ashes, and rampant nettles and thistles. A dreary place, but it seemed a charming and cheerful garden after the close forest. The hobbits felt encouraged, and looked up hopefully at the broadening daylight in the sky. At the far side of the glade there was a break in the wall of trees and a clear path beyond it. They could see it running on into the wood, wide in places and open above, though every now and again the trees drew in and overshadowed it with their dark boughs. Up this path they rode. They were still climbing gently, but they now went much quicker and with better heart, for it seemed to them that the forest had relented and was going to let them pass unhindered after all. But after a while the air began to get hot and stuffy. The trees drew close again on either side, and they could no longer see far ahead. Now stronger than ever they felt again the ill will of the wood pressing on them. So silent was it that the fall of their ponies' hooves, rustling on dead leaves and occasionally stumbling on hidden roots, seemed to thud in their ears. Frodo tried to sing a song to encourage them, but his voice sank to a murmur.
"O wanderers in the shadowed land, despair not, for though dark they stand, all woods there be must end at last, and see the open sun go past, the setting sun, the rising sun, for days end or the day begun. For east or west all woods must fail."
Fail. Even as he said the word, his voice faded into silence. The air seemed heavy, and the making of words wearisome. Just behind them a long branch fell from an old overhanging tree with a crash into the path. The trees seemed to close in before them.
"They don't like all that about ending and failing," said Merry. "I shouldn't sing any more at present. Wait till we do get to the edge, and then we'll turn and give them a rousing chorus."
If he felt any great anxiety, he didn't show it. The others didn't answer. They were depressed. A heavy weight was settling steadily on Frodo's heart, and he regretted now with every step forward that he'd ever thought of challenging the menace of the trees. He was, indeed, just about to stop and propose going back, if that was still possible, when things took a new turn. The path stopped climbing and became for a while nearly level. The dark trees drew aside, and ahead they could see the path going almost straight forward. Before them, but some distance off, there stood a green hilltop, treeless, rising like a bald head out of the encircling wood. The path seemed to be making directly for it. They now hurried forward again, delighted with the thought of climbing out for a while above the roof of the forest. The path dipped, and then again began to climb upwards, leading them at last to the foot of the steep hillside. There it left the trees and faded into the turf. The wood stood all round the hill like thick hair that ended sharply in a circle round a shaven crown. The hobbits led their ponies up, winding round and round until they reached the top. There they stood and gazed about them. The air was gleaming and sunlit, but hazy, and they couldn't see to any great distance. Near at hand the mist was now almost gone, though here and there it lay in hollows of the wood, and to the south of them, out of a deep fold cutting right across the forest, the fog still rose like steam or wisps of white smoke. "That," said Merry, pointing with his hand, "that's the line of the Withywindle. It comes down out of the downs and flows southwest through the midst of the forest to join the Brandywine below Haysend. We don't want to go that way. The Withywindle Valley is said to be the queerest part of the whole wood, the center from which all the queerness comes, as it were." The others looked in the direction that Merry pointed out, but they could see little but mists over the damp and deep-cut valley, and beyond it the southern half of the forest faded from view. The sun on the hilltop was now getting hot. It must have been about 11 o'clock, but the autumn haze still prevented them from seeing much in other directions. In the west they couldn't make out either the line of the hedge or the valley of the Brandywine beyond it. Northward, where they looked most hopefully, they could see nothing that might be the line of the Great East Road, for which they were making. They were on an island in a sea of trees, and the horizon was veiled. On the southeastern side the ground fell very steeply, as if the slopes of the hill were continued far down under the trees, like island shores that really are the sides of a mountain rising out of deep waters. They sat on the green edge and looked out over the woods below them, while they ate their midday meal. As the sun rose and passed noon, they glimpsed far off in the east the grey-green lines of the downs that lay beyond the old forest on that side. That cheered them greatly, for it was good to see a sight of anything beyond the wood's borders, though they didn't mean to go that way if they could help it. The Barrow Downs had as sinister a reputation in hobbit legend as the forest itself. At length they made up their minds to go on again. The path that had brought them to the hill reappeared on the northward side, but they hadn't followed it far before they became aware that it was bending steadily to the right. Soon it began to descend rapidly, and they guessed that it must actually be heading toward the Withywindle Valley, not at all the direction they wished to take. After some discussion, they decided to leave this misleading path and strike northward, for although they hadn't been able to see it from the hilltop, the road must lie that way, and it couldn't be many miles off. Also northward, and to the left of the path, the land seemed to be drier and more open, climbing up to slopes where the trees were thinner, and pines and firs replaced the oaks and ashes and other strange and nameless trees of the denser wood. At first their choice seemed to be good. They got along at a fair speed, though whenever they got a glimpse of the sun in an open glade, they seemed unaccountably to have veered eastwards. But after a time the trees began to close in again, just where they had appeared from a distance to be thinner and less tangled. Then deep folds in the ground were discovered unexpectedly, like the ruts of great giant wheels or wide moats and sunken roads long disused and choked with brambles. These lay usually right across their line of march, and could only be crossed by scrambling down and out again, which was troublesome and difficult with their ponies.
each time they climbed down, they found the hollow filled with thick bushes and matted undergrowth, which somehow wouldn't yield to the left, but only gave way when they turned to the right, and they had to go some distance along the bottom before they could find a way up the further bank. Each time they clambered out, the trees seemed deeper and darker, and always to the left and upwards it was most difficult to find a way, and they were forced to the right and downwards. After an hour or two they had lost all clear sense of direction, though they knew well enough that they'd long ceased to go northward at all. They were headed off, and were simply following a course chosen for them, eastwards and southwards, into the heart of the forest, and not out of it. The afternoon was wearing away when they scrambled and stumbled into a fold that was wider and deeper than any they had yet met. It was so steep and overhung that it proved impossible to climb out of it again, either forwards or backwards, without leaving their ponies and their baggage behind. All they could do was to follow the fold, downwards. The ground grew soft, and in places boggy. Springs appeared in the banks, and soon they found themselves following a brook that trickled and babbled through a weedy bed. Then the ground began to fall rapidly, and the brook, growing strong and noisy, flowed and leaped swiftly downhill. They were in a deep, dim-lit gully, overarched by trees high above them. After stumbling along for some way along the stream, they came quite suddenly out of the gloom. As if through a gate they saw the sunlight before them. Coming to the opening, they found that they had made their way down through a cleft in a high steep bank, almost a cliff. At its feet was a wide space of grass and reeds, and in the distance could be glimpsed another bank almost as steep. A golden afternoon of late sunshine lay warm and drowsy upon the hidden land between. In the midst of it there wound lazily a dark river of brown water, bordered with ancient willows, arched over with willows, blocked with fallen willows, and flecked with thousands of faded willow leaves. The air was thick with them, fluttering yellow from the branches, for there was a warm and gentle breeze blowing softly in the valley, and the reeds were rustling, and the willow boughs were creaking. "Well, now I have at least some notion of where we are," said Mary. "We've come almost in the opposite direction to which we intended. This is the river Withy Wendell. I'll go on and explore." He passed out into the sunshine and disappeared into the long grasses. After a while he reappeared, and reported that there was fairly solid ground between the cliff foot and the river. In some places firm turf went down to the water's edge. "What's more," he said, "there seems to be something like a footpath winding along on this side of the river. If we turn left and follow it, we shall be bound to come out on the east side of the forest eventually." "I dare say," said Pippin. "That is, if the track goes on so far, and doesn't simply lead us into a bog and leave us there. Who made the track, do you suppose, and why? I'm sure it wasn't for our benefit. I'm getting very suspicious of this forest and everything in it, and I begin to believe all the stories about it. And have you any idea how far eastward we should have to go?" "No," said Mary, "I haven't. I don't know in the least how far down the Withy Wendell we are, or who could possibly come here often enough to make a path along it. But there's no other way out that I can see or think of." There being nothing else for it, they filed out, and Mary led them to the path that he'd discovered. Everywhere the reeds and grasses were lush and tall, in places far above their heads, but once found, the path was easy to follow, as it turned and twisted, picking out the sounder ground among the bogs and pools. Here and there it passed over other rills, running down gullies into the Withy Wendell out of the higher forest lands, and at these points there were tree trunks or bundles of brushwood laid carefully across. The hobbits began to feel very hot. There were armies of flies of all kinds buzzing round their ears, and the afternoon sun was burning on their backs. At last they came suddenly into a thin shade. Great grey branches reached across the path. Each step forward became more reluctant than the last.
Sleepiness seemed to be creeping out of the ground and up their legs, and falling softly out of the air upon their heads and eyes. Frodo felt his chin go down and his head nod. Just in front of him, Pippin fell forward onto his knees. Frodo halted. "It's no good," he heard Merry saying. "Can't go on another step without rest. Must have nap. It's cool under the willows. Less flies." Frodo didn't like the sound of this. "Come on," he cried. "We can't have a nap yet. We must get clear of the forest first." But the others were too far gone to care. Beside them, Sam stood yawning and blinking stupidly. Suddenly Frodo himself felt sleep overwhelming him. His head swam. There now seemed hardly a sound in the air. The flies had stopped buzzing. Only a gentle noise on the edge of hearing, a soft fluttering, as of a song half-whispered, seemed to stir in the boughs above. He lifted his heavy eyes and saw leaning over him a huge willow tree, old and hoary. Enormous it looked, its sprawling branches going up like reaching arms with many long-fingered hands, its knotted and twisted trunk gaping in wide fissures that creaked faintly as the boughs moved. The leaves fluttering against the bright sky dazzled him, and he toppled over, lying where he fell upon the grass. Merry and Pippin dragged themselves forward and laid down with their backs to the willow trunk. Behind them the great cracks gaped wide to receive them as the tree swayed and creaked. They looked up at the grey and yellow leaves, moving softly against the light and singing. They shut their eyes, and then it seemed that they could almost hear words, cool words, saying something about water and sleep. They gave themselves up to the spell and fell fast asleep at the foot of the great grey willow. Frodo lay for a while, fighting with the sleep that was overpowering him. Then, with an effort, he struggled to his feet again. He felt a compelling desire for cool water. "Wait for me, Sam," he stammered. "Must bathe feet a minute." Half in a dream, he wandered forward to the riverward side of the tree, where great winding roots grew out into the stream, like gnarled dragonets straining down to drink. He straddled one of these, and paddled his hot feet in the cool brown water, and there he too suddenly fell asleep with his back against the tree. Sam sat down and scratched his head and yawned like a cavern. He was worried. The afternoon was getting late, and he thought this sudden sleepiness uncanny. "There's more behind this than sun and warm air," he muttered to himself. "I don't like this great big tree. I don't trust it. Hark at it singing about sleep now. This won't do at all." He pulled himself to his feet and staggered off to see what had become of the ponies. He found that two had wandered on a good way along the path, and he'd just caught them and brought them back toward the others when he heard two noises, one loud and the other soft but very clear. One was a splash of something heavy falling into the water, the other was a noise like the snick of a lock when a door quietly closes fast. He rushed back to the bank. Frodo was in the water close to the edge, and a great tree root seemed to be over him and holding him down, but he was not struggling. Sam gripped him by the jacket and dragged him from under the root, and then with difficulty hauled him onto the bank. Almost at once he woke, and coughed and spluttered. "Do you know, Sam?" he said at length, "the beastly tree threw me in. I felt it. The big root just twisted round and tipped me in."
"You were dreaming, I expect, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "You shouldn't sit in such a place if you feel sleepy."
"What about the others?" Frodo asked. "I wonder what sort of dreams they're having." They went round to the other side of the tree, and then Sam understood the click that he had heard. Pippin had vanished. The crack by which he had laid himself had closed together, so that not a chink could be seen. Merry was trapped. Another crack had closed about his waist. His legs lay outside, but the rest of him was inside a dark opening, the edges of which gripped like a pair of pincers. Frodo and Sam beat first upon the tree trunk where Pippin had lain. Then they struggled frantically to pull open the jaws of the crack that held poor Merry. It was quite useless.
"What a foul thing to happen!" cried Frodo wildly. "Why did we ever come into this dreadful forest? I wish we were all back at Crick Hollow."
He kicked the tree with all his strength, heedless of his own feet. A hardly perceptible shiver ran through the stem and up into the branches. The leaves rustled and whispered, but with the sound now of faint and far-off laughter.
"I suppose we haven't got an axe among our luggage, Mr. Frodo," said Sam.
"I brought a little hatchet for chopping firewood," said Frodo. "That wouldn't be much use."
"Wait a minute," cried Sam, struck by an idea suggested by firewood. "We might do something with fire."
"We might," said Frodo doubtfully. "We might succeed in roasting Pippin alive inside."
"We might try to hurt or frighten this tree to begin with," said Sam fiercely. "If it don't let them go, I'll have it down if I have to gnaw it."
He ran to the ponies and before long came back with two tinder boxes and a hatchet. Quickly they gathered dry grass and leaves and bits of bark and made a pile of broken twigs and chopped sticks. These they heaped against the trunk on the far side of the tree from the prisoners. As soon as Sam had struck a spark into the tinder, it kindled the dry grass, and a flurry of flame and smoke went up. The twigs crackled. Little fingers of fire licked against the dry, scored rind of the ancient tree and scorched it. A tremor ran through the whole willow. The leaves seemed to hiss above their heads with a sound of pain and anger. A loud scream came from Merry, and from far inside the tree they heard Pippin give a muffled yell.
"Put it out! Put it out!" cried Merry. "He'll squeeze me in too if you don't. He says so."
"Who? What?"
shouted Frodo, rushing round to the other side of the tree.
"Put it out! Put it out!"
begged Merry. The branches of the willow began to sway violently. There was a sound as of a wind rising and spreading outwards to the branches of all the other trees round about, as though they had dropped a stone into the quiet slumber of the river valley and set up ripples of anger that ran out over the whole forest. Sam kicked at the little fire and stamped out the sparks, but Frodo, without any clear idea of why he did so or what he hoped for, ran along the path crying, "Help! Help! Help!" It seemed to him that he could hardly hear the sound of his own shrill voice. It was blown away from him by the willow wind and drowned in a clamour of leaves as soon as the words left his mouth. He felt desperate, lost and witless. Suddenly he stopped. There was an answer, or so he thought, but it seemed to come from behind him, away down the path further back in the forest. He turned round and listened, and soon there could be no doubt. Someone was singing a song. A deep, glad voice was singing carelessly and happily, but it was singing nonsense.
"Hey, doll, merry doll, ring-a-dong, dillo, ring-a-dong, hop along, fell the willow, Tom, bum, jolly Tom, Tom, bombadillo."
Half hopeful and half afraid of some new danger, Frodo and Sam now both stood still. Suddenly, out of a long string of nonsense words, or so they seemed, the voice rose up loud and clear and burst into this song.
"Hey, come a merry doll, dairy doll, my darling, light goes the weather wind and the feathered starling, down along under hill, shining in the sunlight, waiting on the doorstep for the cold starlight. There my pretty lady is, river woman's daughter, slender as a willow wand, clearer than the water. Old Tom Bombadil, water lilies bringing, comes hopping home again. Can you hear him singing? Hey, come, merry doll, dilly doll and merry-o, goldberry, goldberry, merry yellow berry-o. Poor old willow man, you tuck your roots away. Tom's in a hurry now, evening will follow day. Tom's going home again, water lilies bringing. Hey, come, dairy doll, can you hear me singing?"
Frodo and Sam stood as if enchanted. The wind puffed out. The leaves hung silently again on stiff branches.
There was another burst of song, and then suddenly, hopping and dancing along the path, there appeared above the reeds an old battered hat with a tall crown and a long blue feather stuck in the band. With another hop and a bound, there came into view a man, or so it seemed. At any rate, he was too large and heavy for a hobbit, if not quite tall enough for one of the big people, though he made noise enough for one, stumping along with great yellow boots on his thick legs, and charging through grass and rushes like a cow going down to drink. He had a blue coat and a long brown beard. His eyes were blue and bright, and his face was red as a ripe apple, but creased with 100 wrinkles of laughter. In his hands he carried on a large leaf, as on a tray, a small pile of white water lilies.
"Help!"
cried Frodo and Sam, running towards him with their hands stretched out.
"Whoa, whoa, steady there!"
cried the old man, holding up one hand, and they stopped short, as if they had been struck stiff.
"Now, my little fellows, where be you a-going to, puffing like a bellows? What's the matter here, then? Do you know who I am? I'm Tom Bombadil. Tell me what's your trouble. Tom's in a hurry now. Don't you crush my lilies."
"My friends are caught in the willow tree," cried Frodo, breathless.
"Master Merry's been squeezed in a crack," cried Sam.
"What?"
shouted Tom Bombadil, leaping up in the air.
"Old man Willow? Naught worse than that, eh? That can soon be mended. I know the tune for him, old grey willow man. I'll freeze his marrow cold if he don't behave himself. I'll sing his roots off. I'll sing a wind up and blow leaf and branch away. Old man Willow."
Setting down his lilies carefully on the grass, he ran to the tree. There he saw Merry's feet still sticking out. The rest had already been drawn further inside. Tom put his mouth to the crack and began singing into it in a low voice. They could not catch the words, but evidently Merry was aroused. His legs began to kick. Tom sprang away, and breaking off a hanging branch, smote the side of the willow with it.
"You'll let them out again, old man Willow,"
he said.
"What be you a-thinking of? You should not be waking. Eat earth, dig deep, drink water, go to sleep. Bombadil is talking."
He then seized Merry's feet and drew him out of the suddenly widening crack. There was a tearing creak, and the other crack split open, and out of it Pippin sprang, as if he had been kicked. Then, with a loud snap, both cracks closed fast again. A shudder ran through the tree from root to tip, and complete silence fell.
"Thank you,"
said the hobbits, one after the other. Tom Bombadil burst out laughing.
"Well, my little fellows," said he, stooping so that he peered into their faces, "you shall come home with me. The table is all laden with yellow cream, honeycomb, and white bread and butter. Goldberry is waiting. Time enough for questions around the supper table. You follow after me as quick as you are able."
With that he picked up his lilies, and then with a beckoning wave of his hand went hopping and dancing along the path eastward, still singing loudly and nonsensically. Too surprised and too relieved to talk, the hobbits followed after him as fast as they could. But that was not fast enough. Tom soon disappeared in front of them, and the noise of his singing got fainter and further away. Suddenly his voice came floating back to them in a loud halloo.
"Hop along, my little friends, up the way they windle. Tom's going on ahead, candles for to kindle. Down west sinks the sun, soon you will be groping. When the night shadows fall, then the door will open. Out of the window panes light will twinkle yellow. Fear no alder black, heed no hoary willow. Fear neither root nor bough, Tom goes on before you. Hey now, merry doll, we'll be waiting for you."
After that the hobbits heard no more. Almost at once the sun seemed to sink into the trees behind them. They thought of the slanting light of evening glittering on the Brandywine River, and the windows of Bucklebury beginning to gleam with hundreds of lights. Great shadows fell across them. Trunks and branches of trees hung dark and threatening over the path. White mists began to rise and curl on the surface of the river and stray about the roots of the trees upon its borders. Out of the very ground at their feet a shadowy steam arose and mingled with the swiftly falling dusk.
It became difficult to follow the path, and they were very tired. Their legs seemed leaden. Strange, furtive noises ran among the bushes and reeds on either side of them, and if they looked up to the pale sky, they caught sight of queer, gnarled and knobbly faces that gloomed dark against the twilight, and leered down at them from the high bank and the edges of the wood. They began to feel that all this country was unreal, and that they were stumbling through an ominous dream that led to no awakening. Just as they felt their feet slowing down to a standstill, they noticed that the ground was gently rising. The water began to murmur. In the darkness they caught the white glimmer of foam where the river flowed over a short fall. Then suddenly the trees came to an end and the mists were left behind. They stepped out from the forest and found a wide sweep of grass welling up before them. The river, now small and swift, was leaping merrily down to meet them, glinting here and there in the light of the stars, which were already shining in the sky. The grass under their feet was smooth and short, as if it had been mown or shaven. The eaves of the forest behind were clipped, and trim as a hedge. The path was now plain before them, well tended and bordered with stone. It wound up on to the top of a grassy knoll, now grey under the pale starry night, and there, still high above them, on a further slope, they saw the twinkling lights of a house. Down again the path went, and then up again, up a long smooth hillside of turf, towards the light. Suddenly a wide yellow beam flowed out brightly from a door that was opened. There was Tom Bombadil's house before them, up, down, under hill. Behind it a steep shoulder of the land lay grey and bare, and beyond that the dark shapes of the Barrow Downs stalked away into the eastern night. They all hurried forward, hobbits and ponies. Already half their weariness and all their fears had fallen from them.
"Hey, come, merry doll," rolled out the song to greet them. "Hey, come, dairy doll, hop along, my hearties, hobbits, ponies all, we are fond of parties. Now let the fun begin, let us sing together."
Then another clear voice, as young and as ancient as spring, like the song of glad water flowing down into the night from a bright morning in the hills, came falling like silver to meet them.
"Now let the song begin, let to sing together, of sun, stars, moon and mist, rain and cloudy weather, light on the budding leaf, dew on the feather, wind on the open hill, bells on the heather, reeds by the shady pool, lilies on the water, old Tom Bombadil and the river daughter."
And with that song the hobbits stood upon the threshold, and a golden light was all about them. Chapter 7. In the House of Tom Bombadil. The four hobbits stepped over the wide stone threshold and stood still, blinking. They were in a long, low room, filled with a light of lamps swinging from the beams of the roof, and on the table of dark, polished wood stood many candles, tall and yellow, burning brightly. In a chair, at the far side of the room facing the outer door, sat a woman. Her long yellow hair rippled down her shoulders. Her gown was green, green as young reeds, shot with silver like beads of dew, and her belt was of gold, shaped like a chain of flag-lilies, set with the pale blue eyes of forget-me-nots. About her feet, in wide vessels of green and brown earthenware, white water-lilies were floating, so that she seemed to be enthroned in the midst of a pool. "Enter, good guests," she said, and as she spoke they knew that it was her clear voice they had heard singing. They came a few timid steps further into the room, and began to bow low, feeling strangely surprised and awkward, like folk that, knocking at a cottage door to beg for a drink of water, have been answered by a fair young elf-queen clad in living flowers. But before they could say anything, she sprang lightly up and over the lily-bowls, and ran laughing towards them, and as she ran, her gown rustled softly like the wind in the flowering borders of a river. "Come, dear folk," she said, taking Frodo by the hand. "Laugh and be merry. I'm Goldberry, daughter of the river." Then lightly she passed them, and closing the door she turned her back to it, with her white arms spread out across it. "Let us shut out the night," she said, "for you are still afraid, perhaps, of mist and tree shadows and deep water and untamed things. Fear nothing, for tonight you are under the roof of Tom Bombadil." The hobbits looked at her in wonder, and she looked at each of them and smiled. "Fair Lady Goldberry," said Frodo at last, feeling his heart moved with a joy that he did not understand. He stood as he had at times stood enchanted by fair elven voices, but the spell that was now laid upon him was different. Less keen and lofty was the delight, but deeper and nearer to mortal heart. Marvellous and yet not strange. "Fair Lady Goldberry," he said again, "now the joy that was hidden in the songs we heard is made plain to me. O slender as a willow wand, O clearer than clear water, O reed by the living pool, fair river daughter, O springtime and summertime, and spring again after, O wind on the waterfall, and the leaves' laughter." Suddenly he stopped and stammered, overcome with surprise to hear himself saying such things. But Goldberry laughed. "Welcome," she said. "I had not heard that folk of the Shire were so sweet-tongued. But I see you are an elf, friend. The light in your eyes and the ring in your voice tells it. This is a merry meeting. Sit now and wait for the master of the house. He will not be long. He's tending your tired beasts." The hobbit sat down gladly in low rush-seated chairs, while Goldberry busied herself about the table, and their eyes followed her, for the slender grace of her movement filled them with quiet delight. From somewhere behind the house came the sound of singing. Every now and again they caught among many a "Derry doll" and a "Merry doll" and a "Ring-a-ding-dillo" the repeated words,
"Old Tom Bombadil is a merry fellow, bright blue his jacket is, and his boots are yellow."
"Fair lady," said Frodo again after a while, "tell me, if my asking does not seem foolish, who is Tom Bombadil?" "He is," said Goldberry, staying her swift movements and smiling. Frodo looked at her questioningly. "He is, as you have seen him," she said in answer to his look. "He is the master of wood, water, and hill." "Then all this strange land belongs to him?" "No, indeed," she answered, and her smile faded. "That would indeed be a burden," she added in a low voice, as if to herself. "The trees and the grasses and all things growing or living in the land belong each to themselves. Tom Bombadil is the master. No one has ever caught old Tom walking in the forest, wading in the water, leaping on the hilltops under light and shadow. He has no fear. Tom Bombadil is master." A door opened, and in came Tom Bombadil. He had now no hat, and his thick brown hair was crowned with autumn leaves. He laughed, and going to Goldberry, took her hand. "Here's my pretty lady," he said, bowing to the hobbits. "Here's my Goldberry, clothed all in silver green, with flowers in her girdle. Is the table laden? I see yellow cream and honeycomb, and white bread and butter, milk, cheese, and green herbs, and ripe berries gathered. Is that enough for us? Is the supper ready?"
"It is," said Goldberry, "but the guests perhaps are not." Tom clapped his hands and cried,
"Tom, Tom, your guests are tired, and you had near forgotten. Come now, my merry friends, and Tom will refresh you. You shall clean grimy hands and wash your weary faces, cast off your muddy cloaks, and comb out your tangles."
He opened the door, and they followed him down a short passage and round a sharp turn. They came to a low room with a sloping roof, a penthouse, it seemed, built on to the north end of the house. Its walls were of clean stone, but they were mostly covered with green hanging mats and yellow curtains. The floor was flagged and strewn with fresh green rushes. There were four deep mattresses, each piled with white blankets,
laid on the floor along one side. Against the opposite wall was a long bench laden with wide earthenware basins, and beside it stood brown ewers filled with water, some cold, some steaming hot. There were soft green slippers set ready beside each bed. Before long, washed and refreshed, the hobbits were seated at the table, two on each side, while at either end sat Goldberry and the master. It was a long and merry meal. Though the hobbits ate, as only famished hobbits can eat, there was no lack. The drink in their drinking bowls seemed to be clear, cold water, yet it went to their hearts like wine and set free their voices. The guests became suddenly aware that they were singing merrily, as if it was easier and more natural than talking. At last Tom and Goldberry rose and cleared the table swiftly. The guests were commanded to sit quiet, and were set in chairs, each with a footstool to his tired feet. There was a fire in the wide hearth before them, and it was burning with a sweet smell, as if it were built of applewood. When everything was set in order, all the lights in the room were put out, except one lamp and a pair of candles at each end of the chimney shelf. Then Goldberry came and stood before them, holding a candle, and she wished them each a good night and deep sleep. "Have peace now," she said, "until the morning. Heed no nightly noises, for nothing passes door and window here save moonlight and starlight and the wind off the hilltop. Good night." She passed out of the room with a glimmer and a rustle. The sound of her footsteps was like a stream falling gently away downhill over cool stones in the quiet of night. Tom sat on a while beside them in silence, while each of them tried to muster the courage to ask one of the many questions he had meant to ask at supper. Sleep gathered on their eyelids. At last Frodo spoke. "Did you hear me calling, Master, or was it just chance that brought you at that moment?" Tom stirred like a man shaken out of a pleasant dream.
"Eh, what?" said he. "Did I hear you calling? Nay, I did not hear. I was busy singing. Just chance brought me then, if chance you call it. It was no plan of mine, though I was waiting for you. We heard news of you, and learned that you were wandering. We guessed you'd come ere long down to the water. All paths lead that way, down to Withywindle. Old Grey Willow Man, he's a mighty singer, and it's hard for little folk to escape his cunning mazes, but Tom had an errand there that he dared not hinder."
Tom nodded, as if sleep was taking him again, but he went on in a soft, singing voice.
"I had an errand there, gathering water lilies, green leaves and lilies white, to please my pretty lady, the last ere the year's end, to keep them from the winter, to flower by her pretty feet till the snows are melted. Each year at summer's end I go to find them for her, in a wide pool deep and clear, far down with the windle. There they open first in spring, and there they linger latest by that pool long ago.